Miss Margogore, real one. Could you tell me a little something about your family background, please?
Well, I was one of two children. My elder brother was 6 years older than I was. I was born in 1913, and we lived during the First World War in Dawlish in Devonshire. And after the war, my father was demobilised from the Royal Engineers. We went to Southern Ireland, as he was a mining engineer, and we were there in the early 20s through the first lot of troubles with Sinn Féin and a lot of very unpleasant things happening.
Could you describe a little of what actually was going on?
Well, there were a lot of murders. There were a lot of people being abducted, and we were quite near. We lived in Clonakilty. We were quite near where Michael Collins was in fact murdered. And I was taken secretly by an Irish maid to see him lying in state, which is very rather at Skibbereen, which is rather an extraordinary memory, which I do remember very clearly. And of course it was a great shock to the Irish people because he was a hero. And then the mine closed. It was a Baraites mine. And we came back to England to Bedford, where I went to school, to Bedford High School. And I was there until just before 1930, I think, 1929. The plan had been, I had wanted to be a doctor, and the plan was that when I finished taking my higher school certificate, I should go, if I could get a place, to a medical school, or to university, and then to a medical school. But the Great Depression struck. My father suddenly had a cable to say his mine was closing. He was, I think, out in the Middle East somewhere. And he was unemployed for 3 years, so there was no question of going to university or medical school, because you had to pay in those days, unless you were brilliantly clever and got a very, very limited number of scholarships. So I had to nip out and learn to do something, to earn a living. And I took a typing course, shorthand, and I got a job with the British Reinforced Concrete at 32 and 6 a week. And we had to be there sitting at our desks at 9 o'clock, not coming into the building, but sitting at our desks, hands ready to type. And we had an hour for lunch, and we had to be back after the hour. There was no fiddling around. And we left when we'd finished. We had travellers who came in at about 4:30 or 5, and they would give you their day's report from their visits to councils. And you stayed and took it. And that was it. But the only thing I can say is we did have a lot of fun. We laughed a lot. And we used to go swimming, and we used to go to Sadler's Wells for sixpence in the gallery. And if we ran out of money at the end of the week, we walked home. And I don't think we felt aggrieved or deprived. We enjoyed ourselves. We were all in the same boat. I mean, we were all earning very little. And my mother lived in, we lived in Gloucester Road, the bottom of the Broad Walk. And I think that having so little money, what you did do and have, you enjoyed and you appreciated. Well, at that stage, Amy Johnson was doing all her great things, and I don't think any of today's young people realized what a heroine she was to a lot of people, men and women. And any of us who were interested in flying longed to fly because of what she'd done. But of course, it was beyond one's financial means. But in 1938, I saw advertised the formation of a thing called the National Women's Air Reserve, and we met in a pub in Piccadilly. I think it was called the Greyhound or something. And it was Mrs. Patterson Mrs. Gabrielle Patterson, who was starting. She was a flying instructor, one of the first flying instructors in the country, and she had this idea that young women should be given a chance to learn to fly if they wanted to. And it was also apparent at that time that there was probably going to be a war. So we went. I went along to this pub, and there were about a dozen people there. And we enrolled. And she had got some sort of footing at Romford Flying Club. There was a man there who I think saw, who ran it, who I think saw some sort of publicity accruing from this venture. Anyway, we went, we used to meet at Romford at weekends, and we flew, Mrs. Patterson instructing us, for 30 shillings an hour, about, I think. And I took a job at Smithfield Market, typist secretary to one of the meat people. And we had to be there at 5:30 in the morning, but we finished usually about 12, so that I could get on the train at Liverpool Street Station and go to Romford and walk a couple of miles to the aerodrome. And then we had our flying lesson, and we had lectures on rigging and aero engines and navigation and first aid and all that sort of thing. We did quite a lot of work in the hangars, and we handled aircraft and pulled them out for the flying club. We worked quite hard.
Who was actually teaching you?
Mrs. Patterson's husband was an aeronautical engineer. He did the engineering, and we were just the mechanics, and that showed us how to push aircraft about. And we helped the staff to really run the club. Well, then I went solo. I think in November 1938 on a Cirrus Moth. After about 8 hours instruction, and I managed to get in quite a lot of hours, and in August 1939 Mrs. Patterson thought that I was worth instructing in an instructor's course, an assistant instructor's course, and you had to do 100 hours, and she taught me the patter and how to teach. I quite liked teaching, so I didn't find it difficult to learn the patter or to teach.
Could you just describe to me your first flight, how you actually felt being in control of an aeroplane?
On solo, the first solo flight. Yes. The first solo flight really just merges into the distance. You can't remember it even. I mean, you're so unexpected that it's come, that you just fly around the circuit in a bit of a daze and a dream, I think.
Confident in the instruction that you'd have?
Oh, yes. You're not. I don't think people are frightened on their first solo, because I don't think they have really appreciated that they're solo. The second and third time, you begin to think a little bit more. I mustn't make any mistakes. I haven't got anybody here to put it right for me. But they were, it was a Cirrus Moth, and they were very simple aircraft. There wasn't anything really very complicated about it.
Did you find them quite easy to land?
Oh, yes. I mean, they weren't difficult. And then you had to do some cross-country flying, map reading, and they chose the weather for you. They didn't send you off in bad weather. And I passed my instructor's test in August 39, and almost immediately the Civil Air Guard started to send recruits down to the aerodrome, and I was put on with Mrs. Patterson and the other flying instructor, who was somebody called Smith, I think. He was the chief instructor there. We started instructing young men. They were mostly young men.
What were the costs involved in this?
Practically nothing, about 5 shillings, I think, an hour. The whole idea, really, the original idea was the flying clubs were in a very bad way financially, and the government didn't want to subsidise them, but thought of this way of putting money into them and getting something out of it as well, in that we were interesting young men in flying, like the Germans had done, of course. They'd used gliders. They did a lot of gliding. And they really, it was a ploy to get young men ready for the Luftwaffe. And this was the idea of the Civil Air Guard. But of course, it didn't last very long, because the war broke out really almost before it had got, well, it had got going. But I'd only instructed from August until it, the outbreak of war. And then the war broke out, and the flying clubs were shut down absolutely overnight. That was the end of it. The aircraft were pushed into the hangars, and the instructors were called up into the Air Force, and that was it. So Mrs. Patterson said to me, she'd heard, she knew Pauline Gower, she'd heard that there was going to be some form of what they thought was going to be a communication service, that we were going to fly light aircraft as for communication. So she said, don't join anything that ties you down until we see what happens. So a friend of mine had got a job with MI5, who had been moved to Wormwood Scrubs. And I went as I don't know what we were called, but we went and fetched files for the different officers. There was a great thing called the register, and they used to give you a chit to say they wanted a file on somebody or other, you see. And you went and you had to sign for it, and you carted it back and you took it to the man, and then he gave it back to you later, and you had to take it back to the registry. And I did that from the outbreak of war until I was had a letter from Pauline Gower at Hatfield to say that they were taking on some more people. They'd started in January with 6 pilots. Rosemary Reese was one, Joan Hughes was another, and Mrs. Patterson was another one.
What actually had they started?
A small pool had started, and they were flying Tigers. And then they discovered...
Where was it?
At Hatfield. They really had discovered that there was no need for communications, but that there was a need for aircraft to be moved about the country from factories. And the Air Force, of course, was extremely small, and there was nobody really available. So that's when the women joined, they were taken to Hatfield to fly Tiger Moths from de Havilland's.
Could we just go back to the outbreak of war?
Yes.
Could you tell me what your reaction was? Were you expecting it?
Oh, yes. We were expecting it, and we feared that there was going to be the sky sort of black with aircraft and bombs. We really did expect the Germans to launch a great attack on us. We didn't realise, of course, that they hadn't got the aircraft that we thought they had, and it didn't happen. But I was at home, my father was there, when the declaration of war was made, and almost immediately there was an air raid warning, which was a mistake, in fact, we heard afterwards. And I always remember looking out of the window and seeing people running up the Gloucester Road. We had a lot of evacuees from Malta Park. They'd moved them from Malta, and they were all running up to Kensington Gardens, where they'd dug some slip trenches. And of course nothing happened, you see. It was a false alarm. We didn't know what was going to happen. It was an extraordinary feeling when nothing happened, and you wondered what on earth the future was going to hold. Everybody that I knew, my brother was a soldier. He was in India at the time, and they all said that it was only a pause, and the whole thing would hot up. And then, as I say, I got this job. But one felt in limbo almost, that nothing was happening. And all the reports that came through the paper meant nothing. And yet you knew that it was all just waiting to happen, that something was going to happen. And then, of course, Dunkirk happened. And I can remember listening to the radio at the Scrubs about all the boats, small boats, and the army being evacuated. And my brother arrived back in due course. Well, that was really the first time that you realized that it was really on, that the war had really started. And it wasn't a very nice feeling.
So you were at the pool in Hatfield?
So then, early June, I was sent for, and Pauline Gower tested me on the Tiger Moss. We did a couple of circuits and landings, and that was that. And I reported down almost immediately.
Was this how you obtained your A license?
Oh no, I had my A license long before the war with the instructor's endorsement. They wouldn't have taken me if I hadn't got an A license. I had about 280 hours in my logbook at that stage, and they were only taking you if you had 280 to 300 hours.
Was the test particularly difficult?
No. We just did a circuit. I hadn't been off flying for less than a year. You see, so we just flew two or three circuits, and that was that. And I was told to report almost immediately, and went down to Hatfield and stayed at a hotel in Hatfield. And started ferrying immediately. I mean, we were issued with passes.
Any uniform?
No, not at that stage. No uniform at that stage. We just flew in slacks and jackets. But the earlier ones had got their uniform, and then we were sent down to BOAC's tailor in the city and were measured for our uniforms. Slacks, tunics, and a skirt, and a forage cap. And the men had never measured ladies before. They'd only measured BOAC. So they were extremely unwilling to take your leg lengths. So they sort of approached one with their eyes averted and the inch tape, you see. So when my slacks arrived at Hatfield, the seat was hanging down to the knees, because they hadn't been able to get the leg lengths correct, so it had to all go back and be re-measured, which is a very, very funny memory. But I think that almost immediately, in August 1940, that was only 3 months after I'd been at Hatfield, three of us, Philippa Bennett and Mabel Glass and myself, were sent to Upavon to do a conversion course at the Central Flying School onto Miles Masters and Airspeed Oxfords.
What sort of aircraft had you been flying?
Just Tiger Moss. Just Tiger Moss.
To Scotland and Wales?
To Scotland and Wales and anywhere where they were being stored, or if they were going to a flying training school, which they used them as ab initio flying training. So it was a big step to go into a Miles Master, which was quite a monoplane, and it was quite fast. And it was the training machine for fighters. It simulated being a fighter. And the Oxford was a twin, which none of us had flown before, a twin-engine aircraft.
So how did you feel about that?
That was more difficult, really. Because you had two throttles. I mean, you had more controls. They didn't take very long. I think I only did about 2 hours dual on the Master and about 2.5 on the Oxford. And then we just sent off solo. We did a couple of solo bumps.
Did you feel confident after that time?
Yes, funnily enough, one did. The instructor was a very, very good instructor. But I do remember that at that stage we hadn't got our uniforms, so I know that we'd been flying for something like 2 months without uniform, so it must have come quite soon after that. And then we started ferrying quite a lot of Oxfords from Hatfield, because you see they were Airspeed. Oxford were made by de Havillands.
Where were you taking those to?
Oh, they went mostly up into the Midlands, High Erkel, and up into Scotland too.
To aerodromes?
To aerodromes, yes. Sometimes we took them directly to a flying training establishment, and sometimes we took them to what they called maintenance units, where they either added something to them, put something on them, or converted them in some way, or just stored them. There were a lot of maintenance units at High Erkel, and there were quite a lot in Oxfordshire, and up in Scotland too.
So how many actual women were at Hatfield?
Well, 6 originally joined, and then I should think about another 12 joined quite soon.
This wasn't an all-women's pool, was
yes.
it?
Oh, yes, it was an all-women's pool. Pauline Gower was the commanding officer, and we had a woman adjutant, we had a woman operations officer and secretaries. De Havillands did the maintenance of our taxi aircraft. We had Rapides, which were twins, and we had Pusmoths, which took a couple of people.
And I understand at that stage that many aerodromes had no facilities for women.
No.
How did you cope with that?
Well, you see, the WAFs didn't come along for about another year after that, so there were no lavatories at all. So you just found a kindly looking man and said, you know, would you mind keeping guard outside so that no men came rushing in? And we'd go in and use them and then say thank you very much when we came out. And it was, if there wasn't a man about, we'd have to leave somebody outside to say, excuse me, don't come in, a whole lot of females inside. And there was nowhere to stay, of course. You had to go if you got stuck overnight, if you couldn't get back through lack of time or daylight or bad weather. You'd have to find a local pub, a hotel. And it wasn't easy, and transport was difficult. But it was quite exciting in some ways.
What sort of salary were you paid at this point?
Do you know, I can't remember. I would think somewhere around about 600 a year, something like that. I think ultimately I went up to 1200 or 1400 as a commander. We were paid equal in the end. At the beginning, there was we were weighted against when we were only flying Tiger Moths. But once we got on to the full conversions, we were paid the same.
What was the reaction from men at this point to women flyers?
I can't remember any adverse reactions at all. I know that sometimes when you got to an RAF station, they were very surprised to see you, but I never had anybody say anything derogatory to me or nasty in any way. Surprise, maybe, that you'd come in quite a big aircraft. And particularly later on when we came in 4 engines with the flight engineer, they did look very startled when a rather small person got out of a very big aircraft. But prior to that, they had accepted you. I think they were all pleased to see you. But I never personally had anything nasty said to me.
What about the other girls? Did they encounter very much?
I don't think so. I think sometimes you may ask for trouble. You know, you may say something a bit abrasive yourself. And if you didn't do that, I don't think you've got any trouble.
What about the press at this point?
They used to come down and be a bit annoying. I think almost we had more press trouble when Hamble started, because we were almost in a war zone. You know, it was a prohibited area and all the rest of it. And they were inclined to be a nuisance in that they always used to try and get stories about boyfriends, and They wanted to take photographs of you doing silly things like drinking tea under the wing of a Spitfire or knitting or something. You know, they were a bit of a nuisance. But, of course, once, as I say, the war really got going, they were too busy doing other things, and they left us alone, really.
What about reaction from other women that perhaps felt you were taking...
Only right in the beginning. I believe they did. There was a certain amount of correspondence in the paper about, you know, we were taking jobs from men and all the rest of it. But again, that was when the phony war was on, and I don't honestly think that it lasted really when things got going. And it was quite apparent that the men were needed in the Air Force, and we were releasing men to do a job that we couldn't do. And, you know, it was important that they should be released. So it all died out and died away. And I think the next sort of red letter day for us was in July 1941. A Hurricane was brought over, our first operational fighter.
And this was still at Hatfield?
At Hatfield, and six of us did a circuit on it. And that was very frightening, because the entire workforce of de Havilland's turned out to watch us. And we hadn't flown anything comparable to it, and it was a fighter.
And who gave you instructions?
Oh, no, it's a solo. I mean, you had to just get in. One of the instructors brought it over and showed us the knobs, but, I mean, nobody could get in and fly. You had to get in and fly it. That's what having passed the test on the master was supposed to have done for you. You were supposed to be able to go with a certain amount of experience from the master to a fighter. And we all took off in turn, because I think I was the last one, being the most junior. And we did a circuit and a landing. And he said, yes, you're all right, you know, you can all go. So from then onwards, we had Hurricanes on the books. And if one came and you were available to take it, you were given a Hurricane, and that's all there was to it.
Did you enjoy?
Oh, it was lovely, yes. It was very exciting. I mean, we really felt we were getting somewhere when we got it, for a real fighter, particularly as the Battle of Britain had been blazing the year before, and we'd seen it all going on overhead. You know, all the sky trails, and we saw the dogfights too going on above us. So here we were, you know, really getting into an aeroplane that had taken part in the Battle of Britain. It was extremely exciting.